So we are at the point of invoking the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to give them bath. So invoking on page 6 of the essence of nectar, all you assembled to recognize lineage gurus, tantric deities, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, hearers, solitary realizers, heroes, celestials, and Dharma protectors, who dwell in pure realms, forbidden space, each and every one of you, out of compassion, please give me your attention. For countless eons, for countless eons, you have not forgotten your vows to develop the supreme Bodhi mind for our benefit, like the Lord of Birds appearing from the heavens by the force of supernormal manifestations out of compassion. Please come here. Thus the invocation is made. In a frequently scented bath chamber with a brightly shining floor of crystal, beautiful pillars of glittering jewels and a canopy of flowing pearls, I offer ablution to the objects of refuge with pure divine water, just as the gods offered ablution to Buddha Shakyamuni at the time of his birth. Although the perfect body, speech, and mind of the victorious ones are not subject to mental afflictions, in order to wash away the defilements from the body, speech, and mind of all sentient beings, I offer this water for ablution to the victorious ones, made the body, speech, and mind of sentient beings, thereby be cleansed, using numerous jeweled urns, overflowing with pleasantly scented water, the music of many musicians. I offer ablution to the one Gondas and all their spiritual children. This excellent water, most glorious, is the unsurpassable water of great compassion. It is the inspiring water of wisdom. Please grant the accomplishment of my wishes. Now I dry the bodies of the objects of refuge, within an incomparable towel, immaculately clean and infused with fragrant perfumes. Om Atam, Om Hum Tamtri Arkaya Vishodhanaya Swaha. In order to purify my mind, I offer exquisite clothes, which are as bright and beautiful as the variegated rainbow, and with, when touched, are causes of bliss. Thus may I be adorned with the clothing of enduring patience, because they possess natural adornment, the major and minor marks of perfection. I cannot adorn the victorious ones further. Even so, by my offering fine jeweled ornaments to them, may all sentient beings attain bodies bearing the marks of perfection. I offer surroundings of love, hung with fluttering banners and a canopy of concentration, bright with the luminescence of courage, necessities, which are suitable, useful, and excellent. May all beings attain pure wisdom. Please, O conqueror, out of compassion for myself and all sentient beings, and by the force of your supernatural power, remain here while I make these offerings. Thus, the ceremony of ablution is performed. The way to practice seven limbs, which comprise the main point of collecting merit and purifying non-virtues and obscurations, follow the seven-limbed practice. I make obeisance to the Guru, Lord of Sages, who is in this world the manifestation of the three secrets, and who said, during times of strife I shall guide all beings who have not been tamed by the many previous Buddhas. I make obeisance to the direct lineage Gurus, who, by their consummately skillful means of instruction on the vast, profound sutras and tantras, lead me from the immensity immensity of misery, the ocean of cyclical existence in which I'm drowning, to the stairway of the three precious bodies. I make obeisance to the assembled deities of the four classes of Tantra who grant in an instant a state of unification which is difficult to attain, even if one strenuously practices for many eons. I make obeisance to all the Buddhas, the masters, teachers, who, by the power force of their acquaintance for countless eons with the accumulations, have eliminated all faults and achieved every virtuous quality, and who act on behalf of sentient beings spontaneously and continuously. I make obeisance to the Supreme Dharma, the teachings and the realizations, which, if relied upon, purifies all faults and fully gives all excellence of high rebirths and definite goodness. I make obeisance to the Supreme Spiritual Sons of Victorious Ones who never consider their own happiness. Even in their dreams, with great courage, disinterested in their own bodies and lives, they always strive for the happiness of others. I make obeisance to the Exalted Ones who are the hearers and solitary victors, having seen all the realms of cyclical existence as a fiery pit. They relied upon the vehicle of the three trainings. Thus they set out for and reach the city of liberation. I make obeisance to the hearers and celestials in the 24 supreme sacred places who, out of loving concern at all times for practitioners, emanate in manifestations like those depicted in religious dramas. I make obeisance to the Dharma protectors who have vowed to smash into dust the hosts of evil spirits and satisfy every wish of those who properly practice the Supreme Dharma. In brief, visualizing manifestations of my body, equal in number to the planets and pure realms, and chanting an ocean of praise to the virtuous qualities of the objects of refuge with the indestructible faith and great respect, I make obeisance to all those who are worthy of veneration. Joyfully, without reluctance or attachment, I offer all of this in order to please the objects of refuge. Elegant, capacious vessels made of precious materials filled with libation, the ambrosia of immortality, cool spring fed pools of water possessing eight qualities offered for bathing the feet, each pool located along the banks of a lake adorned with delightful lotuses, fields covered with many lovely flowers such as water lily, moon flower, and lotus, the air filled with clouds of fragrant incense made from fine medicinal ingredients, the bright, attractive glows of candles, lamps, as well as the light from jewels, the sun and the moon, gently undulating waves of cool, perfumed water infused with camphor and sandal, a banquet of the invigorating fields of gods and men enhanced with hundreds of colors, tastes, and aromas. The varied music of strings, winds, cymbals, and drums resonating throughout the three levels of the earth. Exquisite forms, superb smells, tastes, and pleasing sounds, and an infinite variety of alluring tactile sensations, the seven supreme treasures of a ruler of men. So with regards to the relying on a guru, here is mentioned how to please the Buddhas and pay respect to them. By paying respect to them, it's very well said. Exquisite forms, superb smells, tastes, pleasing sounds, and infinite variety of alluring tactile sensations, the seven supreme treasures of a ruler of men, natural formations of the eight auspicious signs covering the grounds, verdant forests, enchanting flowers, lakes, oceans, and so forth, whatever offerings there are, without honor, as well as all the possessions and physical forms of myself and others, whatever accumulation of virtue I have gathered from having heard, contemplated and meditated upon the ocean of oral instructions that explain Buddha's teachings of Sutra and Tantras, these marvelous offerings, clouds of sublime offerings vividly arising from the force of my concentration, I extend to all the fields of the accumulation of merit. I present this ocean-like cloud of many types of offerings produced by my faith, intention, and concentration to you, O objects of refuge, out of your great compassion. Please accept them. Then let the accomplishment of all the desirable goals fall like rain on me and every sentient being. At this point, the confession of moral downfalls and the like may be done or not, according to one's wish. Then, from my heart, I confess and promise to refrain from every natural and prescribed non-virtuous deed of the three doors which I have committed previously or urged others to commit, since these deeds are the sole cause of all the immeasurable sufferings. With great reverence and sincerity, I rejoice in the excellent activities, past, present, and future of the Supreme Direct and Lineage Gurus, the innumerable victorious ones, and the spiritual sons. So we're going to have tea. Blessing for the tea. Since we have fallen off the steep cliff of cyclic existence into the depths of misfortune and are oppressed by the thick pitch darkness of suffering, please show the light of Dharma, the path to liberation, to myself and all beings who know not what to do. With your skillful means and great compassion for us disciples who pervade all space, please remain as our protector in whatever physical manifestation will tame us until every being has reached supreme body. I dedicate whatever virtue has been accumulated through actions such as these to the purpose of quickly attaining unsurpassable body, so that I may place on the path to everlasting bliss all these mother sentient beings who have become very weary on the road of cycling existence. So with regard to the guru devotion, so I received teaching from my tutor. So reading these lines, which talk about the kindness of the guru, thinking or contemplating the kindness of the guru when he was teaching me these, Gyabje Tijan Rinpoche cried, and then for about half an hour or so, we remained just silent. He was not able to give teaching at that point. So the kindness of the guru is greater than all the Buddhas. So the Lama is showing us the path or the practice is leading us out of the freeing or saving us from the lower realms of existence. And we need to therefore feel grateful to the gurus. Their kindness cannot be repaid. So, Gyabje Tijan Rinpoche cried. On page 19, where It says, because of the kindness of servants, supreme spiritual protectors, I received and gained confidence in the teachings of the gentle guru protectors, Tsongkhapa, which are difficult to find even when sought for many thousands of years. For these reasons, my spiritual guides are protectors who saved me from the unfortunate realms, huntsmen who take me across the ocean of cyclic existence, guides who lead me to the upper realms of revelation, and so forth. And then the next point is the way to please the gurus through one's conduct. All the happiness and well-being of worldly people and those who have transcended the world are due to the kindness of the spiritual masters. Although this kindness can never be fully repaid, in order to return some of it, I shall try to please them. Just as farmers exert themselves to plant seeds in a fertile land field, why don't I exert myself in offering homage and wealth to the gurus, the supreme fields, even though they do not look for offerings and esteem? I should do this in order quickly to complete my collection of merit. And so the most important practice in one's devotion to guru is to carry out the words of the guru, to practice. The Buddha said that there is a far greater merit in making offerings to a single hair on the body of a spiritual master who teaches one of the unerring paths than to honor and make offerings. Make offerings to the entire assemblage of exalted ones, Hercules, solitary victors of bodhisattvas, and each and every Buddha. Many sages such as Naropa, Milarepa, Dromtenpa, Sakya, Panchen, and Jayulva developed their good qualities by giving up without reluctance to their bodies, lives, and wealth for their gurus. Therefore, I shall strive reverently to serve my gurus with body, speech, and mind, praising and speaking respectfully to them, massaging and bathing them, rising and prostrating to them, and offering whatever cherished wealth I have. So we are at understanding the meaning of leisure and endowments, and then that is finished, and then contemplating the great value of leisure and endowments. So on page 21, moreover, with good foundation, if I wish, I can permanently dispel all the sufferings of cyclic existence, birth, aging, sickness, death, etc., and attain the bliss of liberation with this good foundation. If I practice, I can completely eliminate the two obscurations together with their latencies and effect. The effortless consummation of all good qualities, the state of the three bodies, with this foundation, which possesses the six special elements. If I rely upon the highest tantric practice, I can attain during this short lifetime the two supreme bodies, the actual state of unification. For these reasons, whether one considers the temporary or ultimate meaning of this good fortune, foundation of leisure and endowments, because of its extremely great benefits, the Venerable Gurus have said that it is superior to a wish-fulfilling gem. So extending my motivation beyond actions for this life and training my mind day and night in stages of the body path, the ultimate Dharma, I shall make meaningful this foundation of leisure and endowments which I have obtained. Contemplating the difficulty of finding leisure and endowments, Tugu, who was lame, once rode a wild ass. Similarly, I have obtained this foundation of leisure and foundation and will never have this opportunity again. In general, to attain a happy rebirth, I must accumulate the respective virtuous courses, but since it is difficult for my mind to develop virtuous thoughts, it is likewise extremely difficult to attain a happy rebirth, in particular to obtain leisure and endowments. I must acquire the individual courses for each of the 18 factors, since the acquisition of such Acquisition of such courses is extremely rare. How could complete legend endowments, the result, not be rare? Even if once in 100 lives I acquire every course for attaining legend endowment, there are still many conditions in many mental continuum. In my mental continuum, which destroyed these causes, such as anger, deluded views, and abandoning the Dharma. Even if these causes are not destroyed by such conditions, since the force of my deluded mind and erroneous conduct is strong, and the force of my virtuous mind and conduct, the path is weak, which results are certain to ripen first. Like a star at noon, the teachings of victorious Lord occur only rarely in this world. By considering this, I can see how extremely rare it is to obtain an excellent foundation of legend and endowment. The beings who sink down to unfortunate realms are as numerous as the particles of dust on this vast earth. Whereas the beings who rise up to happy realms are few, like the particles of dust on my fingernail. Was this not said by our protector, the master teacher, who always spoke the truth without deception? The Buddha said that if one compares the infinite number of hell beings, hunger ghosts, and animals to the number of beings which, with a happy rebirth, it seems there are only a few in the form of gods and men. How many ignorant creatures are there in an area of ground the size of a tarpaulin? In a city, the number of people, however many, even if great, is seldom more than 100,000. Among people, consider which are more numerous and which are less, those who have entered the door of Dharma or those who have not entered that door. Again, among those who wish to practice Dharma, consider which are more numerous, those who have complete leisure and endowments or those who do not. The victorious one compared the rarity of complete leisure and endowment to a turtle sticking at his neck. Turtle sticking its neck through the opening of a wooden yoke, floating on the vast ocean, a beam sticking to the wall of a crystal palace, a star seen in the blue sky at noon, a mustard seed remaining on the tip of a needle, and so forth. With many such examples to make the meaning clear, he taught that the body with the foundation of legend and endowments are extremely rare. As shown by such examples and those of the cause and result, this good foundation of legend and endowment is extremely difficult to find, yet I found it this once. Dare I go on without taking advantage of its essential meaning? At this time, free from the 8 leisurely states, I have obtained a life with leisure and endowments. But because I have been distracted by the appearances and I have not taken advantage of the essence, my return to the unfortunate realm has begun. This is like returning to my homeland from the island of Jules, empty-handed. What could be more stupid? What could be a greater loss? In general, to obtain a life with leisure and endowment is rare. In particular, to meet with the teachings of the gentle guru protector is rare. To have such as a refuge, a fully qualified spiritual master is rare. And to have the Dharma, both complete and unerring, is rare. To have discriminating wisdom, within is rare. A mind which can properly utilize the supreme Dharma is rare. A friend who strives for liberation is rare, and sustenance obtained in accordance with Dharma is rare. At this time, when so many rarities have been brought together, if I do not renounce all thoughts and actions for this life alone and follow the path to upper realms and definite goodness, there can be no greater loss. Now, in order to benefit the mother beings who have time and again cared for me with kindness, I shall complete the practices of the profound path without being overcome by unwavering motivation. O spiritual masters, please bestow inspiring strength so that I may accomplish this goal. Contemplating the certainty of death, a good life that is truly meaningful is always difficult to find, and even when found is impermanent and will quickly be destroyed like a dewdrop which clings to the tip of a blade of grass. In this limitless cyclical existence of three realms, whether I take a body in a happy or unfortunate rebirth, in the end that body will not go beyond death. In whatever place I dwell, whether in the upper regions of space, on the ground, in the ocean, or in the crevices of great mountains, I will not be free from my enemy, the Lord of Death. In previous times, when eons have come to an end, in this time, when the five generations are becoming widespread, and again, in future times, whenever I live there, whenever there is no chance to avoid being trampled by the Lord of Death, the gods Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, and the powerful strength of world rulers, armies, the force of sages, the miracles, mantras, and devices of magicians, and whatever other means there may be, cannot turn death away. Even if I pay as ransom an expanse filled with the wealth and possessions of a billion worlds, I will not be released. Even if the venerable medicine Buddha treats me, there will be no remedy for this enemy, the Lord of Death. If I carefully examine all the beings, distinguished and lowly, who lived in the past, I find that now only their names remain, and all of all the beings who are living now, every one of them will someday pass away. My life is not becoming longer, it is running out. Without pausing for a moment, like the flame of a burning lamp, how can it continue and never be extinguished? From the very first moment of my life in the womb, I go to my death without stopping, like a cascading waterfall. Is it not an illusion to think that I will continue to live without ever dying? If someone, while being rushed to the place of execution, is served desirable objects of the five senses, would there be a reason for him to be pleased? Similarly, without pausing for a moment, I am rushing into the presence of death. So even if numerous things that I really desire are gathered before me, would this situation delight me? Since my present status, house, relatives, friends, possessions, and even this body must all pass away without remaining for long. So, to what am I attached in this dream-like present? The years, months, nights, all the time, and all the times are as fleeting as the shadows of the sun. Since they are transient, so how can death not come soon? From birth to now, so many years have passed, and for the remainder of this life, I shall be distracted by sleep and so forth. Since the time left to practice Dharma is so short, is it really enough? In the same way, if I examine even a single day and night to see if I properly contemplate the Dharma or distract myself more, it is clear that because I waste my time, I do not have enough. Since under no condition can death be turned away, in the end I shall surely die. Moreover, because I may die soon without having had enough time, why am I not definitely striving to practice the Dharma now? You're contemplating the uncertainty of the death. Please read on. So this is on the thinking about suffering of the hot rams. It is definitely that I shall eventually die, and furthermore, there is no certainty that on this day I shall not lose my life, be laid in the grave, and find my mind in the intermediate state. In previous ages, people of this world have had immeasurable lifespans. Later, they could live to no more than 10 years. At present, there is no order in which old and young die. What certainty is there now to the lifespan of people in this world? Sometimes in the morning, a person is alive, then later in the day, he is not. When going to sleep, he is alive, but when it's time to awake, He's not. Just now, a person is alive, and now again he's not. The impermanent condition of life is fearful indeed. Every day, head-on collisions occur, and people fall into ravines. Boats capsize in water, and people are burned by fire. Houses cave in, and people are thrown by horses. Bodies, legs, and arms are broken, and people are injured by weapons. Harm from human and non-human enemies. The 424 different sicknesses. The 80,000 types of evil spirits and obstacles, and so forth. The external and internal conditions of death are many. As the 5G generations are now increasing, the means for sustaining life are becoming difficult to acquire, and since medicine is often ineffective, the condition supporting life are few. Indigestible food becomes poison, and unsuitable medicine brings sickness. Since even the conditions supporting life may become those of death, what confidence can I have in the conditions that sustain my life in this world? The various conditions of death, such as illness of air, affect my life, just as wind moves the flame of a lamp. Yet still, I think and act as if I will remain forever. I'm definitely under the evil influence of grasping for permanence. The bodies and lives of people are as tenuous as bubbles and bubble in water. Since even minor circumstances destroy them, looking forward to a long life is a great error. All enduring things, such as the earth, Mount Meru, the four continents, the oceans, will eventually come to destruction. What certainty is there that this body, as fragile as a clay pot, will not fall apart at this very moment? Now I'm healthy and happy, but because my enemy, the Lord of Death, will come as unexpectedly as a cloud in the sky, this is not the time to remain at ease, since it is uncertain which of these two will come first, the dawn of tomorrow or my body and mind of the intermediate state and the next life. Is it not worthwhile to energetically practice the Supreme Dharma now, the way to contemplate that when one dies, nothing but Dharma can help? When I'm seized by my enemy, the Lord of Death, then even if all sentient beings in the three realms gather round me as friends and relatives, I shall be powerless to take a single one of them with me. Even if I own a billion worlds filled with heaps of the seven precious materials, I have no way to bring into my next life so much as a sesame seeds from that wealth. Even the body with which I was born is left behind on a mattress and bedding life, while by the force of the wind from my previous my virtuous and evil deeds, my mind is carried to a place in one of the six realms. For this reason, at the time of death, my body, possessions, relatives, and friends cannot help me at all. The only thing which is really beneficial is the infallible, savior, supreme Dharma. I shall therefore turn away from the meaningless, dream-like activities of this life, and through the stages of the body path, the path of enlightenment, the essence of Dharma, I shall practice to attain the glorious state of Bodhi, or enlightenment. O spiritual master, please bestow inspiring strength so that I may be able to do so. The way to meditate upon the sufferings of a hot health, alas, the meaningful life, so difficult to find, is impermanent and will soon be destroyed. And after death, I have no freedom to choose where I shall be reborn, because that is determined by my previous deeds. The force of my non-virtuous deeds is very strong, and the force of my virtuous deeds very, very weak. If I fall into the fearful abyss of the unfortunate realms, how shall I bear the suffering? Many miles below the earth live the hell beings. The bottom of hell is a blazing ground of burning hot iron. The sides are walls of scorching iron. The sky above is covered with flames. Each individual hell is also made of burning hot iron and surrounded by a wall secured by the four doors. In the reviving hell, the sentient beings become virtuous with each other. With various weapons that arise from their deeds, they strike each other and collapse unconscious. Then from the sky a voice commands, "All of you, revive." Immediately they revive, and after rising, they repeatedly experience the same suffering as before. In the black line hell, the beings are seized by many of the Yama's fearsome men and are forced to lie on the ground of burning hot iron. Their limbs are stretched out like a tarpaulin, and their cherished bodies are branded with many crisscross black lines. Then they experience the suffering of being cut and split open by various weapons along those black lines. In the hell of mass destruction, the beings are herded between two massive iron mountains resembling the heads of lions, tigers, and so forth. Then the two mountains smash together, crushing them, and a river of blood gushes forth. They are forced into large iron machines, which mash them to a pulp like sugarcane. Then they are crushed by huge mountain-like boulders, which fall from the sky, smashing their flesh and blood into paste. In the wailing hell, the sentient beings flee in search of a place of safety. They are admitted into one and the two-level houses of iron that explode into flame. As soon as this happens, the doors slam shut, and there is no way for them to escape. Enveloped by flames, their bodies turn and smoke, burn and smoke, and they pass the days and nights screaming in the hot hell of the beings are fried like fish on a broad expanse of flaming bronze. Flames leap out from all the apertures of their bodies as they are skewered from the anus through to the top of the head with fiery spikes. They are forced to lie down on blazing iron ground where they are pounded with iron sledgehammers. In the extremely hot hell, the beings are pierced through with flaming tridents, and their bodies are clothed in sheets of red-hot iron. They are boiled in a huge bronze cauldron of molten copper, and when flesh and bone separated, their skeletons are spread out on the ground. The flesh and skin grow back, and again, they are cooked as before. In the hell of unceasing torment, tremendous exploding fireballs hurtle down from the four directions and burn the being's flesh, skin, tendons, and bones to the marrow like the wick of a burning lamp. Only by the cries emitted through the force of their suffering, one can know that these are actually sentient beings. The hell beings have searing iron ashes pressed into their hands and are forced to dance in flaming embers. They descend from high mountains of blazing iron and are forced to ascend them again. Their tongues are pulled from their mouths, stretched out and staked down with iron spikes. They are thrown down by Yama's men, who open their mouths with glowing hot forceps, stuff flaming iron bolts into their mouths, and pour boiling molten bronze down their throats, the way to meditate upon the sufferings of neighboring hells. And the next is the way to meditate upon the suffering of cold hells. And then the way to meditate upon the sufferings of the hungry ghosts. And the way to meditate upon the suffering of animals. And then the practice of going for refuge. Then comes the practice of going for refuge. We can go just read through it. His Holiness is on page 34 in the English translation. The way to develop faith of conviction about deeds and their results, actions and their results, karma. Regarding the practice of refuge. Going for refuge to anything other than the three jewels cannot protect me from the intolerable suffering so difficult to bear of hell beings, hungry ghosts, and animals. This is how the three jewels protect me. The Dharma is the actual savior which protects me from the fearful sufferings of cycling existence. The Buddhas are the master teachers of the Dharma, and the Sangha are my helpers in practicing the Dharma. For this reason, if from the depths of my heart I do not seek protection from the supreme, infallible refuge, the three jewels, then I shall have no way to be free from the dangers of this fearful abyss of the lower realms, and particularly of cyclic existence. I shall earnestly take refuge from this moment on, because if I fall into the unfortunate realms, then even if I cry out hundreds of times, there will be no savior to protect me at that time, in that place. Therefore, from now on, I and all other beings go for refuge to the Supreme Masters, the Buddhas. Go for refuge to the Supreme Dharma, which is taught by them, and go for refuge to the Sangha, who practice the Dharma. And recite this verse of actually going for refuge. And therefore, from now on, three, seven, or more times, having affirmed my refuge in the three jewels in like this, I must properly follow the instructions of going for refuge. Having taken refuge in the master teacher, I shall not take refuge in other refuge. Take refuge in other than exalted teachers, nor worldly gods. I shall make offerings and abandon irreverence by venerating even an image of the master teacher as the Buddha. Having gone to refuge to the Dharma, I shall not devote myself to what is not Dharma. I shall renounce harmful thoughts and actions towards living beings and show respect by never stepping over even a single letter of the Supreme Dharma. Having taken refuge in the Sangha, I shall not rely on non-Buddhist philosophers, friends with deluded views, and so forth. I shall have neither attachment nor hatred. I shall respect those who merely wear the seven robes as I do the actual exalted Sangha. So from understanding the various colors of the three jewels and the difference between Buddhism and non-Buddhist refuge, I shall go for refuge again and again to the three jewels. Remembering their kindness, I shall assiduously make offerings to them, offer the first portion of my food and drink as well. With constant remembrance of compassion, I shall influence other beings to take refuge in the three jewels. Respectfully, making offerings and requests to the three jewels at all times, I shall abandon means other than them. Knowing the benefits of going for refuge, I shall do so three times during the day and three times at night. Keeping the three jewels on my crown, on the crown of my head, I shall never abandon them, even as a joke or for the sake of my life. By going for refuge, I enter the door of the Victorious One's doctrine and establish a basis for taking the three pure types of vows. The vows, there are my obscurations and erroneous deeds, and they are diminished or exhausted, and I acquire extensive merit. I cannot fall into the unfortunate realms and be harmed by non-humans. Furthermore, whatever I wish can be accomplished, and I can quickly attain Buddhahood. Since Buddha said that the benefits are inconceivable, I shall take heartfelt refuge and never disregard these instructions. The way to develop faith and conviction about their deeds and their results, if I fear the sufferings of the unfortunate realms, I must carefully check the actions of my three doors, and then, with firm memory, alertness and mindfulness. I practice engaging in even the smallest white deeds and turning away from even the smallest black deeds. All my unbearable sufferings are solely the result of deeds with which I myself have accumulated. Since others have not caused me to experience my suffering, I shall strive to accomplish good and abandon evil now. For example, from planting individual seeds of wheat, barley, beans, millet, rice, and so forth in a fertile field, individual sprouts arise without deviation according to the type of seed planted. Similarly, happiness and suffering in general arise from deeds, and in particular, even the slightest happiness and suffering always arise without deviation from virtue and non-virtue, because it is impossible for anything to arise without a cause or from unsuitable causes. Small deeds grow into large crops. Similarly, in countless successive lives, limitless results of happiness and misery arise from even the tiniest individual virtuous and non-virtuous causes. Just as crops do not grow when seeds are not planted, if virtuous and non-virtuous deeds are not accumulated, no result of happiness and misery whatsoever occur, because one cannot receive results from deeds one has not committed. If seeds are planted, then there is nothing to obstruct them, then crops will undoubtedly arise. Similarly, if virtue is collected and not overcome by destructive forces such as anger and so forth, then resulting happiness will occur without being lost. Likewise, if non-virtue is accumulated and not counteracted by the purifying forces, confession, and so forth, then resulting suffering will occur without being lost. Thus, deeds individually produce definite and increasing results. If deeds are not committed, results are not received. Once they are committed, their force is never lost. Like a person full of desire and unsatisfied with his wealth, I shall earnestly strive to accumulate only good deeds, diligently collecting even the smallest. I shall be careful not to destroy with anger and so forth the good deeds that I have already performed. I shall never commit any non-virtue, abandoning even the smallest. I shall be as afraid of bad deeds as I would be of a poisonous snake coiled in my lap. With the four forces, I shall be sure to purify the non-virtue I have already collected. In particular, I shall not be content with mere attainment of high rebirth, because that is greatly surpassed by the attainment of Bodhi. I shall therefore diligently practice to acquire all the causes for attaining a most excellent life with the 8 matured advantages. O spiritual master, please bestow inspiring strength so that I may be able to do this. Teaching in common with a person of intermediate scope, the way to meditate on suffering, human sufferings, if I abandon evil and strive for virtue, then I will surely attain a high rebirth. But if I do not attain the state of liberation, which is the complete cessation of all the suffering of cycling existence, I can have no peace of mind, because again I will wander in the unfortunate realms. Furthermore, I will have no chance to be happy even when I attain a high rebirth, for essentially the nature of cycling existence is suffering. For humans, the womb is filled with germs and the stinking filth of pus, blood, and like. It is horrible to be confined in such a dark, cramped, uncomfortable place. As a fetus, my body is cold as if bound and completely wrapped up in the placenta. Because of my mother's behavior and so forth, I experienced many sufferings for long periods. From the full maturation of my deeds, I am bone. The force of air turns me upside down. Then from the cervix, which is fettered, unclean, and very narrow, like a machine made of bones. I am born in extreme misery, violently and with unbearable sensations of roughness. The misery of birth is an unwanted suffering that falls like rain. It is truly something to be feared. My body, at first so youthful, gradually changes. Then, as if suddenly transformed, it is hunched. My color is poor, my hair white. My gait unsteady, even when I walk on level ground. As my muscle tones deteriorate, I'm covered with wrinkles and my skin hangs loosely. As my rows of teeth crumble, I crave food. I speak indistinctly and become extremely forgetful. I become blind and hard of hearing and have trouble sitting down and getting up. Others treat me with contempt. Even food and drinks are difficult to enjoy or digest. Everyone is disgusted with me. Daily, I am oppressed with a distressing thought that now my health is deteriorating and soon I shall die. The suffering of aging is truly depressing. When I am stricken by illness, with my elements in disorder, moving around is difficult, and I've become bedridden. I constantly moan with severe pain and do not pass a day or night without crying. Unable to enjoy what I like, I am given disagreeable food, drink, medicine, and so forth. I must undergo operations, burns, and other treatments, as agonizing as the continual torment of sickness. My complexion pales, and my voice becomes feeble. Unable to rise, I cannot do what I want. Because I am in the grip of illness, my environment, body, possessions, attendants, and friends all seem like enemies. I pass the day and night despondently, increasingly oppressed by the wretchedness of dreading death from my ailments. The suffering of sickness is truly vicious. By physical illness or other conditions, I am heading into the mouth of the Lord of Death. When I am seized by the violent illness of death, I lie down for the last time on a bed. Doctors are no help. Prayers do not turn death away. I and others give up hope for my life. Sobbing relatives and friends gather around and wash my face with tears. I utter my final words, and then my corpse is prepared for the grave. My nose stops functioning. My mouth goes dry, my eyes roll upwards, and I gasp for breath. When these things happen, one after another, what can I do? I'm tormented with anguish from attachments to my relatives, body, possessions, and friends, and filled with regrets for my evil deeds. With the violent pain of my life functions disintegrating, my with the violent pain of my life functions disintegrating, my arms and legs flail and so forth. The suffering of death is truly frightening. These four enemies, birth, aging, sickness, and death, turn the wheel of cycling existence and torment me. And since there are many other sufferings in between them as well, I have no chance to remain happy. If confronted with the horrors of dreading hostile enemies, robbers, carnivorous bees, non-humans, fires, floods, and so forth, my mind is imprisoned in a dungeon of misery. Heartbroken and with deepest regret, I am separated without any choice from my relatives, possessions, and circles of friends. When this happens, the memory of them brings anguish. Whatever I utter comes out in sobs and chokes. With tears, I faint. I pound my fist, tear my hair, can barely speak and refuse to eat. Many farm, but do not reap a harvest. Many raise livestock, but the herds do not thrive. Many enter commerce, but do not make a profit. Many beg or borrow, but their hopes are not fulfilled. Most of us search with numerous hardships for the things we desire, but do not find them. Instead, the things we do not want, such as frost, drought, disputes, attachment, litigation, and so forth, fall on us, the poor. must work in such places as factories. They are oppressed as the servants and slaves of others. The affluent are always troubled with trying to protect and increase their wealth. Moreover, those who are hot, cold, hungry, thirsty, and impoverished fight and argue among one another. Even we in the human realm are disturbed by so much suffering that it is similar to being in the unfortunate realms. The way to meditate upon the sufferings of demigods, then the way to meditate upon suffering of desire realm gods, and then the way to meditate upon suffering of gods in the two higher realms. Next topic is the way to contemplate the six sufferings. The flesh and bones of all bodies which I have previously taken birth were preserved. If the flesh were preserved, they would equal the size of Mount Meru. If blood and lymph were collected into one place, they would equal the breadth and depth of ocean. I have been Brahma, Kushika, and a world ruler. I've also taken birth in the ordinary bodies of gods and men. Although they are difficult to count, I have already relinquished them all. So what security is there in obtaining a body? My worst enemy of previous lives becomes my friend in this life and tries to help me. My friends of previous lives becomes a real enemy in this life and tries to kill me. Even in this very life, Of the sun and the moon, eliminating the four continents, but later I had to lie down in the dark cavity of hell. I tasted the nectar of gods, but later I had to eat blood and molten copper. I dwelt in heavenly jeweled palaces, but later I burnt in the flaming iron houses of hell. I was served sensual offerings by the upper realm goddesses, but later I was harmed by the gods of hell. Early in my life, I was proud of my wealth and power, but later in my life, I was destitute, unable to find food. I was rich with costly silk garments and jewels, but when I die, I went naked and empty-handed. Oh, of all the most excellent things obtainable in the second existence, are there any in which I should place my trust? I have long known my Dharma companions, intimate friends, and circle of relatives, and have grown fond of them. But eventually, like a hare pulled from butter, I will wander alone to an unfamiliar place in the next world. Should I really place trust in companions and friends? In previous lives, I dwelled in the palaces and gardens of the gods, enjoying the taste of ambrosia and youth. In the human realm, I have worn fine clothes, enjoyed good food and drink, been close to my friends and so forth. The number of times that I have enjoyed desirable objects of the five senses is more than equal to the number of dust particles in this world. But while I've enjoyed these things, my increasing desire has brought me such suffering. The suffering of dissatisfaction is indeed distressing. The Buddha said, that if the molten copper we drank as hell beings, the silt we consumed as worms, the filth we ate as dogs, pigs, and so forth were gathered, it would completely fill this world. Moreover, the tears we wept from the heaviness of our misery would be greater in extent than the ocean. This was taught by the Buddha. Yet still I am not disgusted or afraid. What is mind made of? Iron? The Buddha taught that if this vast earth were turned into mud and then made into pellets about the size of juniper berries, Even these could be fully counted, but there is no apparent beginning to the births a person has taken from his mother. Since this is the beginning, since this is beginningless, how can a limit be shown for the number of times that I have been born in cyclic existence? This I must carefully consider, the way to contemplate the three sufferings. And then the way to contemplate the process by which one is caught up in cyclic existence, and a way to practice the path that leads to liberation. So our bodies and minds are tormented the way to suffering, contemplate three sufferings. Our bodies and minds are tormented not only by the suffering of misery. The Buddha taught that in the realms of cyclic existence, all contaminated feelings, which appear to be pleasant, are merely the appearance of happiness and a temporary halt of suffering. Their nature is not happiness. Especially, we in the realms of cyclic existence are always bound by the suffering of conditioned existence. In brief, when I must carry a heavy load that is difficult to bear, there is no occasion for happiness. Similarly, as long as I must hold on to these contaminated aggregates, I will have no chance to be happy. These contaminated aggregates. Are produced by the power of my previous deeds and mental afflictions, and they continuously possess the seeds of all my suffering and mental afflictions, which will later develop. These contaminated aggregates which rise to all my future births, are the basis for all the suffering of this life, birth, aging, sickness, and death, and so on. The suffering of misery and the suffering of change develop in the way that bubbles do from water. Contaminated aggregates from their inception are determined by deeds and mental afflictions. Their nature is unhappiness and suffering. Therefore, if I do not attain the highest peace, cessation of all the suffering of my aggregates, then wherever I am born, in the three realms are among the six types of beings, it'll be like living in a pit of thorns. Because the three sufferings are nature of cyclic existence, I will have no chance to be happy. Now is the time for me to gain freedom from this prison of cyclic existence. Then the way to contemplate the process by which one is caught up in cyclic existence, the way to practice the path that leads to liberation, like a water wheel. I have always encircled round and round, helplessly taking births among the six types of beings, and thus have been continuously afflicted with the three types of suffering. I must consider the cause of all this. From time without beginning, thoughts like I have been in the depths of my heart because of this terrible demon grasping at self-existence. I discriminate between myself and others, and so I develop attachment and hatred. With attachment and hatred, I accumulate deeds, and because of these deeds, I circle in cyclic existence. Therefore, if I do not counteract my grasping self-existence, I will not become free from cyclic existence, and since I must counteract it with wisdom, relies on self-existence-lessness. I shall practice the training of extraordinary wisdom. Furthermore, if my mind is distracted by dullness and agitation, I will not perceive phenomena according to their self-existentless true nature. Therefore, after pacifying all distractions, I must practice the training of single-pointed concentration on profound true nature. It is impossible, moreover, to develop concentration while lacking memory, alertness, and mindfulness. I must therefore practice the training of extraordinary morality, strictly disciplining my three doors with unwavering memory and alertness. For this reason, Buddha said that the heavily laden heavily laden crops of wisdom training grows from atop the sprouts of steadfast concentrations, and that since the field in which they grow is morality itself, the vows of individual liberation are the root of Buddhist doctrine. I shall therefore listen to the instructions concerning the foundation of the three trainings, the vows of individual liberation. I shall develop respect for the master, teacher, and his precepts, and with memory and alertness and mindfulness, I cultivate the antidote for each of my mental afflictions, tightly shutting the four doors through which moral downfalls occur. I will try never to transgress the precepts laid down by the peerless, compassionate master teacher. Thus, I will establish the root of his teaching in my mind. O spiritual masters, please bless me so that I may be able to do this. And then teaching concerning the person of great scope. His Holiness has covered the way to contemplate why one must engage in the practices of great vehicle, under which the topic, the way to practice mental equilibrium, the way to meditate upon knowing all sentient beings as mother, the way to meditate upon remembering kindness of the mother sentient beings, the way to meditate upon repaying the kindness of mother sentient beings, the way to meditate upon love, the way to meditate upon the extraordinary compassion and an extraordinary attitude, the way to the method of equalizing and exchanging self and others. Since all sentient beings, so regarding this topic, the last one, the method of equalizing and exchanging self and others, since all sentient beings have been my kind parents, it would not be right for me to neglect them and cherish myself. I can see that self-cherishing has been the cause of all my suffering and that cherishing others has been the cause of all my happiness. Moreover, Buddha said that whatever happiness there is in the cyclic existence and transcendence comes from wanting happiness for others, and whatever encumbrances there are in cyclic existence and solitary peace come from wanting happiness for oneself. In brief, children are disturbed by waves of suffering because they cherish themselves. Haven't the Buddhas attained a state of perfect bliss because they cherish others? So, if I wish never to suffer, I must give up self-cherishing. If I wish to enjoy unending happiness, I must strive to cherish others. May all the sufferings of my mothers, together with the causes of their suffering, ripen upon me, and thus may they be free from all suffering and its causes. May all of the temporary and ultimate happiness, together with any virtue I have, ripen on these beings, and thus may they all possess supreme bliss. So meditate in this way, loving sentient beings by sending them to your happiness, and having compassion by having compassion by taking on their suffering. Then practice the extraordinary attitude and the development of Bodhi mind, as explained previously, and six perfections, as explained below. So the way to train in the six perfections. Attainment of the supreme state of Buddhahood will not be accomplished merely by thinking, may I attain it. I shall therefore take the Bodhisattva vows, endeavor to follow the practices and engage in the activities of spiritual sons. So, and then next comes instructions of four ways of gathering disciples, and then the way to meditate upon perfect serenity, the way to meditate upon extraordinary insight, and the way to enter the Vajra vehicle, and then the conclusion. Now, from the collections of both merit and wisdom as vows and space accumulated through the effort I have made for so long in these practices, may I become chief of victorious leaders for the sake of old beings whose minds have been blinded by ignorance. Then recite this concluding prayer: Alas, in all my life, in all my previous lives, I have circled in cyclic existence like a water wheel, most often wandering in places of no leisure, without meeting this excellent path. In this life, I have obtained a foundation of leisure and endowment. I am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide and have met the supreme path. To remain at ease now is extremely foolish. Therefore, abandon actions done solely for this life. Just as the snake sheds its skin, I shall strive day and night on the excellent path and so make this life meaningful by the force of the virtue I have created in this way. In all my subsequent lives, may I never be separated from the ways of the Dharma, and may all beings be liberated through this path. And then the author says, thus the essence of an actor, the Supreme Dharma, the way to practice profound instructions on the stages of the path of enlightenment, has been set forth in verses that cover the essential points and avoid complex arrangements of the subject matter. My name is in Sanskrit is Jnana Virya. At the Ganden Samdenling Hermitage in Kongyu, in the Kongpo region, I, the lowest of Buddhist practitioners, composed this text with the intention of performing scanning meditation myself, and also with the hope of benefiting others of similar fortune. By virtue of this, may the essence of Buddha's teachings become a banner of victory that will never vanish. Sarada. So His Holiness wants to go through the Shamar Lamrim. Just read from a little from the beginning. So with this regard to this text, Shamar Rinpoche from Amdo was somebody from whom the 13th Dalai Lama received many teachings. And then I saw in my childhood, I saw some pictures of two lamas. One was introduced to me as Shamar Rinpoche and the other as Dayang Rinpoche. And so Shamar Gendun Tenzin Rinpoche was the author of this text, which is treatise on the path of enlightenment, laying, which actually is an explanation of the path of bliss. So I received this teaching from one lama from Golok, who had actually received the teaching from Shamar Rinpoche himself. So the sun radiating light of goodness and munificence, laying out the points of guided meditations on the path of bliss, a treatise on the path of enlightenment, equaling the expanse of the space. So this is the title then, equaling the expanse of space of knowledge in the three realms, in times, magnificent with the sacred light of excellent wisdom. So here the knowledge and excellence are actually the names of his teacher, Sherab Gyatso. From the depths of my heart, I bow to my kind master, skilled in spreading out the delightful lotus of scripture and realization until the end of ocean. With the sweet dew of the ear-whispered instructions of the good intelligence, Losang, the host of honeybees sing the melodious song of scripture, Lung, and logic, Rigpa, I once again collect the infinitely vast, ripening and liberative intrinsic deeds of the oceans of your compassionate magical sport. In the endless ocean of virtuous deeds beyond limit, your beautiful perfect form of complete sphere, appear exquisitely from which you sprinkle forth the nectar of wisdom. To you, full moon amongst the sage teachers, my obeisance. Ajita and Manjukush, the embodiments of compassion and wisdom respectively, and Nagarjuna and Asanga, the best lamps illuminating the profound and extensive paths, I bow to you and your teaching lineages. Clarifying the sweet, clear river course of the land of snows, which has been polluted by the dirt of misunderstanding, you became the trailblazer of the unmistaken complete path. I worship you on my crown, O glorious Dipankara Shrijan. Through the hundred thousand rays of unprecedented wisdom, you outshine the 10 million constellations of sweet talkers, O good intelligent Lozang, the renowned son. When I found confidence in you as the unity of the three lineages, I bow to you with highest reverence. And so His Holiness read just the beginning of these verses. So where we would be meeting again for the next teaching is uncertain, as there's no telling the future. So when and where we will have the next teaching. So we have actually completed the teachings on the eight great Lamrim texts together with others as well. So it has been really fortunate for me to have been able to give these teachings. Although I lack any practice, but the lineage of teachings I have received on these texts, I have passed it on to you. And the most important thing, having received this teaching, is to practice. So tomorrow we'll have the initiation of Avalokiteshvara. I will start the preparation for preparation ritual around 6:30. I will be on the throne here tomorrow morning around 6:30, and then while I do this preparation, while I go through the preparatory ritual for the initiation, the monks should carry on with their debate, like dialectical debate, as you would do today. So I would like to test how good is my single-pointed concentration, whether I would be distracted by your voice and noise, or whether I can actually stay absorbed in meditation. So we'll start around 9:30, the initiation. So by about 9:30 or 10:30, we'll finish the teachings, and then we have this Tibetan elected political leadership, Sikyong. Since 2011, I resigned from the political responsibility. I already talked about this last year. We already talked about this. So we have the religion, the column for religion and culture of the Tibetan Central Tibetan Administration. Since we have very large number of people gathered here. And then there is the chairperson of the Tibetan parliament as well, who has come here. And perhaps Samdong Rinpoche also, because he was the first elected leader of the Tibetan people and has 10 years experience of having run the Tibetan administration. And he also being a reincarnated tulku, he is familiar with the functions, administrations, and so forth of the monastic institutions down here. And also, because of his involvement in the Tibetan political administration, he also has lots of experience And therefore, perhaps Rinpoche would also give a speech after the initiation tomorrow. So first, today, we'll have a debate session. So we also had the teaching, and then we'll have the debate today. So as we say, that the three qualifications of a learned person is learned in debate, learned in teaching, and learned in writing. And so we would be actually engaging in the we have engaged in the teaching, and then next is the debate, and then slowly the monks can write books. And so tomorrow the initiation may start around 8 and finish around 9:30 or 10. And then after the teaching, then the three personalities, the chairperson of the Tibetan spokesperson.
Hello, Namji Sokhon.
Speaker. The Speaker of the Tibetan Parliament, then the Kalun, the Cabinet Minister for Religion and Culture Department, and Samdon Rinpoche will give talk. So with regard to the Shamar Lamrim, His Holiness just finished at the point where it says, so here the guided instructions on the stages of the path of enlightenment, which is the main path treaded by all the victors of the three times, which condenses the essential meaning of the 84,000 scriptures into the paths, paths to be practiced by the fortunate ones, and which is the personal instruction that certainly proves greatly beneficial to all three types of practitioners. Highest, medium, and lowest is explained in two parts. How to rely on a teacher, the root of the path, and having relied on him, the steps of training the mind. The land and circles surrounded by the snow mountains, you are the source of good and happiness. Lord Chandrasik, Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until the samsara ends. Indam Guru Ratnamandalakam Niyatayami. So at 5 o'clock today, there is a program at the Tibetan Camp Number 1 in the Community Hall, Luksong Community Hall in Tibetan Camp Number 1, which is the main market there. Simgi Samang. So the rest of the monks have been also told to hold debates. The monks who in Madhyamaka and Prajaparamita classes should also hold debates. So the debate basically is on some topic, which is about mind. According to Abhidharma Kosha,
Samo, So debate is regarding the other secondary mind factors, how it will go in correspondence to the primary mind, whether there is possibility of the attachment and anger going together in accordance with one single primary mind. So according to one of the quotes from Abhidharma Kosha, it states that there is no possibility that the desire and the anger cannot go in accordance to with one single mind. And is there a possibility that with someone who is in deep sleep, is it possible to have concentration in them? And they say it's possible. Is there a possibility to have concentration? Someone who is in deep sleep, it's impossible to have a concentration because the debate says that there is no consciousness when someone is in a deep sleep. And he says there is a possibility that there will be a mind. So the person who is in a deep sleep, whether that person can be referred to as a person who do not have any kind of mind while he is in a deep sleep, and whether the sleep itself is a mind or not. So he says that when someone is in a deep sleep, there is no concentration. So when the one who answers first says something, and later if he was not able to hold on to his agreement, then they call tsa, which means that he is defeated for that topic. For a mind, if it has the potential to still focus, then can we say that also a part of concentration goes around with that mind? So what is the nature of concentration, whether it is the potential of the mind to stay focused or not? So generally I wanted to say that where there is a mind, there has to be a concentration. And what is the definition of joyous effort here? So effort is something out of our aspiration or willing to engage in the world. Joyous effort is a mind which goes only to positive minds, not around the neutral or the negative minds. So are you saying that if the joyous effort goes with the mind, then that mind has to be a positive one? Then if a mind is aspire or working towards all the object, irrespective of whether it's a positive, negative, or neutral, then are you still wanting to maintain that it is still a joyous effort? We are here discussing the topic according to the tenets of Vaibhashika. So this is according to the Vaibhashika tenets. When someone is in a deep sleep, we do not see that they have mind. So even though the sleep itself is a mind. So according to the Vaibhashika tenets, we speak of only three occasions where there are no mind. The one is when someone faints and when others are in meditative absorptions. So apart from these three states, all the other states need to have an evident mind. So the answer one sees this, it's not three, but there are five different states. And when someone is in deep sleep, is one of the state where there are no consciousness. And he wants to maintain that when someone is in a deep sleep, then even sleep doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So, Maramada. So, what is the nature of sleep? So he says the sleep is a mind under the categorization called secondary mind, which goes around one primary mind. So the topic is from Madhyamika philosophy. He quoted the two words from engaging in the deeds of Bodhisattva. And without analyzing the negation of the object of negation, it is impossible to generate the understanding of emptiness. So he's asking which text? So he says the text is engaging in the deeds of Bodhisattva. And actually, he's raising the quote from Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary on the Middle Way philosophy. And the concern outline is the identification of the purpose behind identification of the object of negation. And what is the other outline which comes with it? It's the identification of the negative negation of object of negation. So kindly explain me these two sentences. And he says that if you, without understanding what is the object to be negated, it is impossible to understand the positive side, which is the emptiness. And what is the object of negation here? So can you explain the concept of understanding the object of negation through an example? So if I take an example, for example, me, the self, which is the object of the grasping. So even though that object of negation, self, as an eternal, doesn't exist, but we have to understand if the self exists as self-sustaining, then how it has to exist. So this is the meaning. So without identifying the object of negation, which is the truly established, we cannot ascertain the emptiness. So how can we identify the object of negation, which is the truly established? So even though there is the truly established doesn't exist, but if something has to be truly established, then there may be a way that we can explain that it has to establish in this way. So this is how we have to identify it. And you were speaking about assumptions because we cannot generate the complete understanding about rough understanding. So how can we generate the rough understanding of the object of negation? And he answers that if something is established truly, then there are many ways that it has to establish. For example, the seven different ways that can be established. So in such way, it has to establish. So when someone identified this, the object of negation, so can we make a difference between the self, the general self, or the conventional self, difference between the conventional self and the ultimate self. And is it possible to generate such a basic understanding before seeing the emptiness? So he says that we do not need to cognize it, or we do not need to see it with a valid cognition, but we need to have a rough understanding of how it has to be, the existent mode of self. So he's taking a quote from Lama Tsongkhapa, states that before understanding all the phenomena as absence of inherent existence, there is no possibility that anyone will get even a rough understanding of the reality. So he says that here the differentiation is through based on a valid cognition. But what I said is to find the differentiation by a mere assumption. So to know something with a valid cognition and to have a rough understanding based on an assumption is different. So the debate is about identification of the object of negation. So object of negation actually doesn't exist. And according to debate, if something doesn't exist, then there is no way that we can understand or see it. But here we see that even though we do not understand it, we have to get a rough understanding of it, or to understand it if it does exist. So he's debating whether in order to understand the conventional self, is it necessary to identify the object of negation first? He says that if we identify all the phenomena as mere designated, session there. 전 트랜스미션 해결해요. 막 까사래. 까사래.
당신.
아, 네. So the text is the Rosary of the Golden Rosary by Lama Tsongkhapa. So the topic is about the self, and self as being eternal, and self as being impermanent. And the view of self as an eternal is the view of the Samkhya tradition of Indian Buddhist school. And they perceive, they consider the self as both eternal and also impermanence and impermanent. So this is the view of Samkhya school. So here, the self is eternal. So can you explain further what do you mean by self is eternal? And how does the Samkhya school explain it? And how to explain the self is impermanent? So he says that, the Samkhya school says that the self is a kind of a soul that exists without dependence upon other factors. So that's why they consider the self as an eternal. But then the Buddhist philosophical tenets assert the self as impermanent. And also when you divide the continuum of the of a phenomena or of an impermanent phenomena into different moments, even at the moment of a second, we distribute into 65 different paths, even for a second. So how do you explain it further? So how do you explain the changes when we speak about momentarily changes? So how do you define it? So momentarily, the changes is the definition of impermanence. And what is the ultimate moment, the shortest moment possible? He says, by clapping a hand, and if we divide into 65 different parts, then one part is the tiniest or the shortest possible moment. It's not 60, it's 360 different paths. But that is not the ultimate one. Even it can go even further from that. So when you say 360 different paths divided into one moment, divided into 360, do you have any background sutras or the texts supporting your assertion? So normally we speak about 65 different divisions. So if you do not say that, then I have a quote here, which is the Chandakriti in his 400 verses. And even the mental consciousness will be momentarily changing. And here the moment is the ultimate shortest moment, which is one instance of 65 divisions. So this is his code to prove that one of the 65th is the shortest duration. So if you say 64, then among the 64 different divisions is one, so one of the 64, is it the ultimate shortest moment? So then if someone understand that tiniest moment, then do they have to understand the subtle impermanence nature of the phenomena? He says no. Then he says because that itself is what is subtle impermanence. And if something is a subtle impermanence, then if you cognize it, then you have to cognize the subtle impermanence. If you are a subtle impermanent phenomenon, so if you cognize that phenomenon, do you have to cognize the subtle impermanence? The answer one says no. The last moment of a burning candle, the last moment of the candle which is burning, the second moment it will die out, right? So this is also an example of the ultimate moment of an impermanent phenomena. But someone who sees that doesn't necessarily need to understand the subtlest impermanence, because we all can see that. He says the ultimate moment of the shortest and the ultimate moment of the burning candle, the last moment light of the burning candle, is it the ultimate impermanent? He says that so the debate is still around the same topic, without the last moment of the burning candle is the subtlest impermanent phenomena or not. And when someone cognizes it, do they have to cognize the ultimate impermanent phenomena? The basic concept is that for ordinary beings, we are only able to see the impermanence of a phenomena inferentially. We are not able to cognize directly the impermanence. So the rule and the style of the debate is such that the people has to start first, one person, and he first say the name of Manjushri D, which represents wisdom, and he's requesting Manjushri to bless him to give wisdom for this debate. And it's always started with a verse from a certain text, and they have to know from which text this sentence or the quote comes from, and he has to also identify the relevant outlines and the author. So the current topic is about the Vinaya, and Vinaya we have different promulgations. And he's speaking about the downfalls, the ethical downfalls. And some sections of the ethical downfalls are related to timing. And the timing suggests if a person engages in a negative or such things, and the action won't be complete until the next morning sun rises. So he's asking them about the sutra, which concern... the phrases of the sutra, which present all these ethical setbacks. So, how, according to Vinaya, how many downfalls ethical downfalls are there, which needs that next morning's sins to rise in order to complete that action. So the actual text that he quoted is from Guna Prabhas, the root of Vinaya. So Acharya Guna Prabha is one of the most important masters of Vinaya. So he's asking, what are the seven quotes from the sutra that Guna Prabha has used to present the forms of the different downfalls? The first it reads that when the next morning sun rises, the ethical setback will be completed. So here they're discussing about the condensing factor of the Vinaya ethical setbacks, because in the sutras, all of these ethical promulgations are presented very detailed, with each ethical setbacks with their origin stories and so on. But in the Guna Prabha, in his text, presented them by summarizing, by presenting one ethical setback, and we have to apply the same to others and different vows. So they are speaking about a certain ethical promulgations that the monk will get if a bhikshu goes to a king's palace and he cannot return in the king's palace. He has to return back before the sunset. And if he stay near the premises of the king's palace, near the queen's, and if the tomorrow morning sunrise, then there will be an ethical setback for him. So they are discussing about the nature of that ethical setback. So that particular ethical setback, which in relation to a bhikshu going to the king's palace, so now it is written that it is a must that so tomorrow morning, the next morning's sun has to rise. So until the sun rises, the ethical setback doesn't complete. But in one of the texts, it is written that it is said in a different version that when the sun rises, that ethical setback will not be there. So there is a contradictory between these two contradictions. So how do you explain it? So if you apply the same method to others, so how do you apply it? There are a few ways. Sometimes if the reasons behind prescriptions are same, then we apply it again to another ethical discipline. Sometimes the reason behind the prescription is same, then we also give the reason to another ethical setback. For example, Lord Buddha has prohibited the monks from digging the ground soil, but he doesn't say anything about sand. But since the reason behind the ethical prescriptions of monks walking in a field is same as monks walking in a sand mine, so therefore monks are prohibited from walking in the sand mine as well. So they're asking the reason behind these details. tindi tindi man menda tindi tindi. La. So the debate is from. So the debate is from epistemology, the Pramana Vardhika, and the chapter is about next rebirth. So this is a reasoning to prove the existence of the previous life. So there are four different reasons to prove the existence of previous life. The first is that what we call the reasoning of familiarization, that whatever we do, as soon as we are born in this world, there are many things that we do automatically. And the reasoning here implies that even though we feel it automatically, but it is due to our familiarization in the previous lives. So this is one of the reasons. A baby who was just born, we can prove that he has done such kind of actions even in his previous life by which he was able to familiarize in this life because it is a mental continuum. So it says that if it is a mental phenomenon, so it needs similar continuation of mental phenomena preceding it. So what is a mental continuum which is similar to the mental continuum that precedes it? So here they are discussing about the similarity nature of a mental phenomena and another mental phenomena that comes after it. So the mental continuums are normally of two types. One is called the continuum or substantial continuum, which is very similar to the mind to be continued. Then there is another one called a similar mental continuum. So what is the difference between substantial and similar mental continuums? So they are asking, what do you mean by similarities in terms of mental continuum? So whatever the continuum of a mental phenomena, are they all similar? He's taking the example of the mental continuum of a person. And he's asking whether the mental continuum of a normal sentient being, will there be a time that it will cease to exist? He says the continuum, the similar continuum will cease, but the mind itself will never stop. Did you So a normal person, is it possible that his mental continuum will go until he become enlightened being? So then the mental the mind of a normal person and the continuation which is in the Buddha's state, are they similar? Because one is in a normal person's mind and another is present in an enlightened being. And are they too similar? So then before you say that, when someone becomes enlightened, you say that the similarity of the mental continuum will cease. But then you're saying that when he becomes enlightened, that continuum still exists, and this is a contradiction. So he's answering very intelligently. So he's asking whether if the continuum of a mind continues to stay, then is it not different? Is it impossible to have the continuum cease? So the debate is about the mental continuum, the difference between mental continuum in a normal person and when it progresses further to enlightened being. Because we say that every phenomenon, every impermanent phenomena needs to have a continuation. And also the mental factors need to have a unceasing continuation until even after one becomes enlightened. So he says these two minds, the mind of a normal sentient being and the mind of an enlightened being, he says that the continuation is same. Then he's asking whether they are similar. But then his debate is that it's not similar because one is in a normal person and other is an enlightened being. But he answers that even though the persons are different, but from the mind's point of view it's same. Even though they are similar in terms of continuity, but they themselves are not similar, he says. So is it the same thing? It is the proving the previous rebirth. This falls under the Pramana Vradhika, the epistemology section of debate. So he says that the reasoning is same as before that I put forward. The reasoning revolves around the life of a baby, who's just born, and whatever the activities he did are all being accustomed in his previous life.
Ah.
So you put forward the reasoning based on that infant, right? So then how will the person understand that there is a previous life based on your reasoning? He says that when you come to know that that little infant which is just born has also a mental continuum that precedes, then you already understand that there is a previous life. So then are you saying that a baby who is just born, if we understood that he has a mental continuum that comes before, that precedes his present mental continuum, then he understood the existence of previous life? He said, yeah, it's correct. So are you still going to maintain that? They're trying to put stress on him. So his reasoning is that when we put forward such kind of reasoning, we have to prove that prove the existence of previous life to a person, right? So then who is that opponent? Is it non-Buddhist or Buddhist? So then if the opponent is a non-Buddhist, he has to understand three important factors related to that reasoning, isn't it? So are we putting forward that reasoning to a person who doesn't accept previous life? He says that it is impossible. If you put that reasoning to a person who do not accept previous life, then he will refuse the reasoning immediately. So he is here standing to say the dedication prayer, dedicating the merits for the flourishment of this teaching all over the world, and may His Holiness live for thousands of years and benefit all the Tibetan people. Thank you.